Welcome to Grounded Wellness. I'm your host, Bethany McDaniel, founder of Primally Pure, mom of three, and biohacking enthusiast. We created this podcast to bring you practical advice to live a more vibrant and intentional life rooted in long-lasting health. We record right here on our regenerative farm, grounded with our feet in the soil. Exploring bold truths, overlooked wisdom, and holistic tools that support true well-being. These conversations will challenge everything you know about health and wellness. Today's guest is someone whose expertise and perspective is exactly what all of us need to hear right now, especially as we rethink the way we protect our skin and honor our connection to the sun. Dr. Teo Soleimani is a Stanford-trained, double board-certified dermatologist and skin cancer surgeon who operates on some of the most complex and high-risk cases of skin cancer. Known as the anti-dermatologist, Dr. Teo believes in a more simple, ancestral way of caring for the skin. His philosophy bridges cutting-edge science with an intuitive understanding of how diet, light, and lifestyle impact the skin and overall health. He's here to literally shed light about why fear around sun exposure may be misplaced, how chemical sunscreens may be doing more harm than good, and what true holistic skin health really looks like. Get ready for a conversation that might challenge a lot of what you thought you knew about the skin, sun, and health. Let's dig in. Dr. Teo, thank you so much for being here. I am so confused right now because you're a dermatologist and we are outside in the middle of a sunny pasture. You're not wearing UPF clothing. You're not wearing a hat. You told me earlier you don't have sunscreen on. I feel like I'm living in an alternate universe. What is going on?
Well, thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here. And a lot of what we may talk about may not be status quo for my specialty, but I will tell you the evidence-based stuff and I will tell you my opinions because I think there's a lot of misconception in my field. You're right, I'm not wearing UPF clothing and I am not wearing sunscreen right now. Am I in midday bright sunlight directly overhead? Not that much, right? And we bring up a bunch of things, and what you're touching upon is the sun, and should we fear it or should we embrace it? And I think we should do both. And why I bring that up is, like with everything in life, too much of a good thing can be a bad thing. But the sun, for the majority of what we use it for and our well-being, both physically and mentally, is a good thing. I think me being a little bit more olive skin and a little bit more baseline tan, I know my skin's risk, right? I know how much sun my skin can tolerate before it burns. So I am fine and comfortable as both a dermatologist and a skin cancer surgeon to be outside, unprotected, before I hit that threshold. So do I think I need UPF clothing? Maybe. Do I think I need it right now? No. Do I think I need sunscreen right now? No. But I will make that decision based on my own personal skin health and my own understanding of its benefits.
I love everything you just said, and I just heard a lot of common sense, but that unfortunately doesn't seem to be the norm in the field of dermatology.
Yeah.
What do your colleagues say? How do they react when you make a statement like that, which feels very, like I said, common sense to, I think, most people, but would seem to be blasphemous among the field of dermatology?
Well, I'll tell you it's controversial, but you have to look at evidence. I trained in some really amazing institutions, and evidence-based medicine is what I practice in my practice and what I've been taught to provide patients. We know from just a skin cancer risk that there is an entire subset of skin cancers that are not related to the sun. In fact, our most life-threatening skin cancers, particularly in younger patients, don't have what we call a UV signature or a UV mutation signature. So this misconception of you have to fear the sun, you got to protect yourself from birth to adulthood and beyond, I think is overkill. I think it's been overdone. Now, why do we do that? Why do we as dermatologists make a big stink about the sun? Because I can't control your genetic predisposition. So I can't control what your family's genetic pool has provided you. So what I can control is environmental injury or insults that I can protect against. So my goal as a dermatologist and both as a skin cancer surgeon is to keep you safe, keep your skin safe, and keep you away from things that can kill you from a skin cancer standpoint. But I think the sun provides a lot of benefits that we tend to ignore. And in fact, in fearing the sun, it doesn't reduce the likelihood of dying from a certain skin cancers. So I don't think we should fear it. I think we should respect it because, you know, try to sit outside for a week in the sun and you'll burn, right? And a sunburn's never a good thing. It's your skin dying from excess UV exposure. But I think sunlight makes us feel better. It provides some benefits, vitamin D synthesis. It actually modulates our skin's immune system. We'll go into that in a little bit. But there's a lot of things the sun provides. I go out every single day. I get 20 or 30 minutes every single day, whether it's in the morning or in the afternoon playing with my kids. And I feel completely fine telling my patients to do the same.
So skin cancer is the number one cancer in the United States. But here's where it gets confusing. We've been told for decades to slather on sunscreen every single day, but the rates of skin cancer continue to rise. Why is that?
So there's a few important factors. There's some variables we got to take into consideration. So skin cancer is the number one cancer in the world. And in the United States, one in four Americans will develop it.
Wow.
Interestingly, the most common causes of skin cancer death are not preventable from sun protection. So melanoma historically has been our deadliest form of skin cancer, and it's the number two cause of cancer death in young women ages like 25 to 35.
Wow.
Those skin cancers tend to arise from mutations in our skin's genetics that we can't control for. What is important to know is that the sun will contribute, too much UV exposure will contribute to certain garden variety skin cancers that may or may not play a significant role in your longevity, in your well-being, but surely we don't want those.
And so what would you consider a garden variety skin cancer?
Yeah, so things like early squamous cell carcinomas in elderly patients, certain early basal cell carcinomas. And interestingly enough, there's been several really big sunscreen studies. A large one in 1999, it was like our gold standard published in The Lancet that looked at really strict sun protection with sunscreen versus no sun protection with sunscreen. And the incidence of basal cell carcinomas, which is our most common skin cancer, didn't change. And in fact, although there was a slight decrease in certain squamous cell of the melanoma, there was no change in melanoma-specific deaths.
Wow.
So we've become a sun fear-mongering society. I think its intentions were originally good to keep people protected, but we've gone kind of way out the deep end. And I think kind of coming back to normal common sense is a much better idea.
Can you give a breakdown of the different types of skin cancers and which ones are sun-related and which ones are not?
Totally. So there's a lot of forms, but the three big ones we talk about, which is the predominant forms in the U.S. and the world, are melanoma.
The most deadly.
Exactly, or historically has been the most deadly.
Okay.
Squamous cell carcinoma and basal cell carcinoma. And these make up essentially 90% to 99% of our skin cancers. Melanoma historically was our deadliest form of skin cancer. A lot has changed in the last 5 years. It's no longer a death sentence. You know, famously, our former president, Jimmy Carter, had it in his brain, and now he's been alive. We've saved him from dying from melanoma with certain medications, but it's the one we take the most serious because of its ability to spread throughout the body. What people don't understand is that the vast majority of life-threatening melanomas, particularly in young patients, are not sun-driven. They occur in areas of sun-naive skin, backs, abdomen, upper legs, young men and women. In fact, it's the second most common cause of death in young women, but those melanomas don't have a UV signature. So we make this big stink about avoid the sun, but of our most lethal form of skin cancer, it makes an insignificant difference. Now, this doesn't mean go outside and burn all the time. Dr. Teo said, go do whatever. But we have to be pragmatic here, right? Squamous cell carcinoma is our second most common form. And now, unfortunately, it's become the number one cause of skin cancer death in the U.S. that tends to be a little bit more linear in terms of chronic excess sun damage. We see farmers, coal miners, people who live at the beach, you know, deserts with aged, wrinkly, rough skin. Over time, those develop these what I call garden variety skin cancers. Interestingly, squamous cells that go on to kill patients don't have a UV signature. The majority of them don't have the UV signature that we see in sun-damaged skin.
So it can cause, or it can be related to squamous cell cancer, but not the most deadly form.
Yeah, and we're just understanding this interplay between sun, our immune system, the skin, cancer biology. There's a really cool study that came out several years ago that looked at cosmetic surgery patients, and they took, when we did eyelid lifts, when we do an eyelid lift, we normally discard the extra loose skin that we take out. Well, we studied the genetics of those of that skin, and we saw the same mutations in the skin that we see in skin cancers. But those eyelid skins were normal. They didn't have any cancers. So we're just now understanding, well, what does this all mean? Mm-hmm. What this means is, one, there's a lot more to it than just you get sun, you're going to get skin cancer, which is why I don't want people to fear the sun. What I want them to understand is if you start to burn all the time and too much of it, well, you're not doing your skin a favor. The other important thing is to understand our immune system and how it plays a role in protecting us. We know that as our immune system gets weaker, skin cancers increase. In fact, patients who have autoimmune illnesses, patients who are on medications to weaken their immune system, and older patients have the highest risk of skin cancer, regardless of sun exposure.
Just because their immune function isn't where it should be.
The immune systems are the police of our body.
Yeah.
So things grow and our immune system takes care of it. As that weakens, things like weeds grow that we can't control for, and they become a problem.
And as you're talking about this, I'm thinking about vitamin D.
Yes.
The sun is probably the best source of vitamin D. I mean, people can supplement as well, but perhaps the best natural source of vitamin D is from the sun, which plays such a critical role in immune function, which protects us against skin cancer. So how does vitamin D factor into the equation?
Totally. And before I touch into that, I forgot to mention the most common form of skin cancer, which is basal cell carcinoma.
Okay.
And that one doesn't have the ability to hurt you in terms of a threat to your life. It doesn't have the ability to spread inside the body, but it is functionally or cosmetically destructive. That is even less understood because in all of our sunscreen studies, and we touched about this earlier, but patients who used diligent sunscreen versus those who didn't, there was no significant difference between the rates of basal cell carcinoma formation. So we're still scratching our head saying, what the heck is, what's the player here?
Yeah. And is it like another ray that sunscreen doesn't protect against?
It's family history, genetic predisposition, immune dysfunction, too much UV altogether.
Yeah.
If it was truly UV related, that rates of basal cell in equatorial countries should be higher than Northern European descent. And we don't see that. That's where family and genetics play a big role. So you touched about vitamin D, and vitamin D is a really interesting vitamin, which is a fat-soluble vitamin that's been studied almost ad nauseum now about its effects on overall health, certain skin diseases, certain internal diseases, you know, all sorts of things. And you're right, I agree with you. Vitamin D, the best source, in my opinion, is skin, is getting it from the skin synthesized naturally. But my medical counterparts will argue that we've looked at patients in heavy sun-exposed areas, surfers, people in Ecuador, Panama, Hawaii, Colombia, and we found that they are vitamin D deficient as well. My argument to that is I don't think our current testing models represent biologic activity.
Mm.
I think just because a level is beyond a certain marker doesn't suggest whether even that messenger or that chemical is doing its job or not. It can't be that everybody in the world is vitamin D deficient. That's silly. And I also don't like supplementation from a vitamin D perspective for several reasons. I see a lot of vitamin D toxicity. Patients come in with a lot of problems from vitamin D toxicity. Yeah.
I thought that was a pretty rare thing, but
no, because everybody thinks that they can self-medicate. And if we're going to treat this as medicine, it should be treated in a controlled fashion. I still think getting vitamin D from the sun is the best source. What we do know is that deficiency in vitamin D over long periods of time have been shown to be a problem in autoimmune diseases, certain cancers. In fact, there was a really interesting study that looked at women in Sweden who avoided the sun for fear of melanoma. And they looked at those who avoided the sun, and they had the same rate of cardiovascular mortality as pack-a-day smokers.
Wow.
And the thought was that their immune dysregulation, partly due to low vitamin D, partly due to sun avoidance, and probably other habits that they were doing in fear of melanoma, resulted in the same immune dysregulation that pack-a-day smokers had.
That's
Nobody talks
crazy.
About that study.
No.
And it was over 20,000 women in Sweden. It was a very good study.
A really big group.
Now, I'm not saying if you get a bunch of sun, you're never going to have a heart attack, or if you get a bunch of sun, you're never going to get skin cancer. That's not the purpose of this. But I think being outside produces some natural synthesis of vitamin D that we need, and a component of wellness that I can't measure in a test tube. You feel better outside.
Yeah.
When I was training on the East Coast, I had, you know, what they call in medicine a seasonal affective disorder. I call it just being sad because it was cloudy, you know. And when the sun would come out, I would feel better and I would perform better. I was better at my job. I was happier. And I don't have a test tube measurement for that. But I know when I felt better, I was healthier, and it translates.
Yeah, I don't think science has fully caught up with all of the healing benefits that sunlight and everything on the earth has to offer yet. But like you said, it's something that we can all feel and that we've all experienced when we're outside, when we get natural sunlight, not too much, but the right amount.
Yeah.
It feels really good.
Yeah.
You can't deny that.
I agree.
I remember in like the 90s and early 2000s when I grew up, there was a lot of talk about how the ozone layer is diminishing, and therefore we all need to be more vigilant about sunscreen use. How much of that was real, and how much of it was just marketing for us to start using more sunscreen as a society?
So the depletion of the ozone layer was real, for certain, and it did provide the ability of certain rays of sun, particularly X-rays, gamma rays, UV A, B, and C, to penetrate. However, common sunscreens only protect for UVB and UVA. All the other stuff that got through the holes in the ozone were not blocked by the common sunscreens we use anyway. Hmm. So if we were to think, you know, there's a hole in the ozone, which means there's some mutagenic rays coming through, what are other ways we can take protection? And I tend to say, shade, shelter, supplement, sunscreen, in that order. So the ozone's changing now for the better. People have gotten smarter about the stuff we're doing to the environment, and we're allowing the earth to rebuild. The ozone layer that was depleted is closing. That still doesn't mean that we shouldn't take some form of protection, but the sunscreens we put on barely blocked UVB back in the 90s. So it didn't even do anything for the stuff that was getting through to begin with.
And how would you say sunscreens work now to prevent both UVA and UVB adequately?
Yeah. Oh, sunscreen is such a controversial topic, and I recommend it for my patients. I think common sense things are, if you have a reason to shield yourself from too much UV exposure, and I don't like to like to use the term sun. I don't even think it's sun. It should be against specifically UV, right? I like the old school zinc and titanium based sunscreens, the stuff in the 1980s and 1990s that you saw the lifeguard with the white nose at the beach or at the pool. Those are time tested. They're the broadest spectrum. They cover UVA and UVB very adequately, and they're safe for all intents and purposes. What's happened in the last 20, 30 years is the cosmeceutical industry has found that the old sunscreens had a chalkier feel, so people wouldn't be able to put it on under their makeup very comfortably without residue, grittiness of their skin, or this kind of pasty feeling that they didn't like. So out came the chemical sunscreens as a need or desire to have something that felt more elegant on their skin, in which you can cover with makeup. The problem is that the chemical sunscreens, in reality, have a whole slew of questionable concerns. And I'm in the camp that there are some problems, some significant problems, with the chemical sunscreens available in the U.S.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
What are some of the biggest issues with chemical sunscreens?
So one thing people don't know or understand is actually how chemical sunscreens work. So chemical sunscreens work by absorbing UV light, undergoing a mutation or a change, a chemical reaction in your skin, and releasing that chemical reaction energy as heat. So they're actively undergoing a chemical reaction on your skin. The problem with that is these are chemicals we are putting on our skin that were made or synthesized in a lab. And we didn't know at the time when these products were being developed in the late 90s and 2000s, what their breakdown products meant. We just knew that the active ingredient would absorb UV A and B, undergo a shift, release that energy as heat. But the degradation product we found are actually carcinogens in a lot of the chemical sunscreens. There's some notorious ones that have been banned in Europe and Australia because of how carcinogenic their metabolites are. We still have them in the US, which is a big problem. And then the other thing that we didn't know, or maybe we did know and we didn't talk about it, I'm not sure, is that a lot of these chemical sunscreens are organic phenol derivatives. So they're molecules that mimic the structure and shape of our natural hormone chemical messaging signals in our body. So one problem with sunscreens is we tell patients, or at least collectively as dermatologists, we tell patients, put this stuff on your skin from 6 months old to 80 years old. We're talking decades of application. In any common sense, you would think, wait a second, I'm putting something on every single day of every single week of every single month of every single year, compounded over years. Is this stuff getting in my system? Am I absorbing this? Am I inhaling this? Like, what does this mean? And only now are we finding out after 20 or 30 years of data, like, wait a second, this can interfere with natural hormone messaging signals. They mimic the same molecules in our body, or at least some of them do. And they're not as inert as we think. Actually, a big study that came out in JAMA a couple years ago showed that one application of a chemical sunscreen on our skin was detected in a blood test at nearly 200 to 500 levels above what we considered safe and normal. So wow. Only now are we figuring out, wait a second, the stuff we said in the 90s and 2000s that's great and became widely flooded on the market is probably not as safe and harmless as we thought.
Yeah. And if you think about, I mean, that's just one application. 100%. If you think about every application over the course of one day in 100%. The sun and then a week in the sun, a lifetime.
100%. I mean, our babies, our kids, elderly patients, patients right. with, you know, different types of skin that, you know, maybe they have more sensitive, absorb, you know, kids have a skin type that behaves more like mucous membranes, especially when they're young, especially before a year or 6 months.
They absorb everything.
You know, we're telling people to put this stuff on every single day. And, you know, that brings up a really important fact that people often overlook. The American Academy of Dermatology and the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends against using chemical sunscreens for infants 6 months and younger. Why? Because we know that stuff is absorbed. We know those chemicals may not be safe. And it's been like that for years, but nobody talks about it. So you assume, if we knew something was wrong or if we knew something was questionable, why are we telling everybody else to put it on, but not for babies?
Right.
Right?
Right. Man, there's so much to unpack here. So these chemicals, a lot of them are endocrine disruptors. They are actually causing a chemical reaction to happen on our skin, which has carcinogenic or cancer-causing byproducts.
Yeah.
So is it safe to say that the products that we've been told to use to protect ourselves from skin cancer may actually be contributing to skin cancer?
Maybe. I don't know if they're directly contributing to skin cancer, but they may be contributing to other cancers, lymphomas, leukemia, certain other issues that we're noticing. In fact, one of the most commonly available chemical sunscreens, octocrylene, undergoes a chemical reaction in our skin, and the breakdown product is a product called benzophenone, well-known carcinogen, like very well documented in the literature, but for some reason, we still have it in the United States. Now, am I saying avoid all sunscreens at all costs? No, of course not. You know, people burn, they get blistering sunburns. We know the consequences of that. But if you were to ask me, there's a group of sunscreens that doesn't really have any data suggesting it's harmful besides the fact that it goes on your skin kind of chalky. And then there's a group of chemicals that have a bunch of publications, whether it's in lab studies, animal studies, or in humans, that have questionable properties. Which one would you pick?
Yeah.
It's a common sense thing. Pick the safer one, right?
Which is the physical.
Yeah, which like is the physical zinc and mineral. Yeah, exactly. Zinc, titanium. In my practice, I don't recommend chemical sunscreens. That's my personal preference and opinion. If I'm going to have somebody apply sunscreen, it's because I, as a physician, want to protect their skin. I treat it as a medicine. I don't treat it as makeup. I treat it as medicine.
Which so, it technically is.
It is.
I mean, the FDA regulates 100%. It as a drug.
It is. It's an FDA defines sunscreen as an over-the-counter drug, same as Tylenol, same as Advil. So if I'm going to treat it as such, and maybe my patients don't think the same, but I don't really care if it's chalky. If it's doing its job and it's safe, I've done my job. Mm-hmm. Now, in my opinion, there are even better ways to protect your skin than sunscreen. I probably put that as third or fourth best. I like shade and shelter. I like clothing. You know, those have never been questioned to cause any sort of chemical reaction on your skin unless you're like, I don't know, jumping in a vat full of benzene with your clothes on. But those are, you know, you will never burn in shade. It's literally impossible. You can sit at the beach for 30 days in a row under shade and you'll do fine. Try sitting at the beach for 30 days with sunscreen on, you will burn. So that's like my common sense approach to sun protection.
I agree. I think about it in the same way. Like finding shade, I think, is the best thing to do. If
for
you've
sure.
had a long day in the sun and like you can feel it, you know,
yeah,
you can feel when it's been,
yeah.
when it's a little too much.
Yeah, yeah.
And then finding shade or like wearing a hat, wearing clothing. Yeah. What's the deal with UPF clothing? Does that really protect you? Because I have never burned under any clothing garment, UPF or not.
Very good question. So part marketing, part not. The defining features of what makes clothing a certain UPF number is the weave of the fabric and the material of the textile. So some materials are more reflective of light sources. Some materials are less reflective. So all clothing has some component of UV protection. You're right. I've never burned with even a t-shirt on, whereas my arms that were exposed have gotten sunburns before, or at least have gotten a tan. Now, everybody's what I call minimal erythema dose or sun sensitivity or UV sensitivity is different. Some patients are very sensitive to UV. They may have skin conditions that make them very sensitive to UV. Think of things like lupus or melasma or, you know, what we call spring eruption or polymorphic light eruption. Some people have a history of a lot of skin cancers that are sun-related. So they may need a little bit higher protection than, say, you or I. But part of the UPF popularity is marketing, because all clothing will have some component of sun protection. Some of it is true. When you go up into the 50s range, really, it's a much tighter weave of product, and it's a textile that tends to be a lot more reflective than natural cotton.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
What about spray sunscreen? Oh. What is your take on spray sunscreen?
I hate that stuff.
Me too.
I hate that stuff. Two reasons. Every time I've had a sunburn as a kid, it's been with spray sunscreens. Every time I've had an uneven, you know, tan or uneven burn, it's from spray sunscreens. And now we're finding out that the majority of the propellants that get the sunscreen product out are some sort of benzene derivative. So you're spraying this all over your body. You're inhaling it every time you apply this. And we know, obviously, anything in the benzene family tends to be a carcinogen. We tend not to recommend this. If we're going to treat sunscreen as a medicine, then we should make sure most of it, if not all of it, is safe. Now, people will come back and say, well, the amount of benzene is not a lot, but we're treating this to diagnose, treat, or prevent something, right? People will make the argument, well, you're getting more inhalational benzene when you go pump gas. Possibly, though I don't agree all the time, but assuming that's
especially
true,
with children,
100%, they're not feeling gas.
Trying to avoid it.
Yeah,
you know? They're 100%. Not like holding their breath while their mom
100%.
Is covering them in this cloud
100%.
Of benzene
every day.
Yes,
every day, and you're spraying it on areas where, like, if I'm at the, like, let's say that argument's true, right? I'm not at the gas station sniffing the nozzle that I put in my gas tank, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we're spraying this on their face, shoulders, back, So that's number one.
And you benzene can smell that stuff
100%.
From like 20 yards away.
100%.
It is so offensive.
Yeah.
It is like my number one pet peeve.
100%.
At the pool when all of, I know right away, I'm like, okay, who's spraying the sunscreen?
It aerosolizes and goes far. So that's number one, the propellant. That's a huge problem. Number two, most of them are chemical sunscreens. Most of them are chemical sunscreens with a bad degradation product. Number three, the application, the amount you need to apply to get the actual SPF number on there is a shot glass worth. That's like the simple description. Wow. Nobody's ever spraying a shot glass worth of product on their body. They're maybe getting like a whiff of it, which is why they, you know, most patients burn with spray sunscreens. It's just, it's become this marketing thing because it's easy to use and you can grab it and go and think you get some protection.
Do you remember back when we were growing up, because we're the same age, we figured this out before we started recording.
I look a lot older.
No, you don't. We're like within a month of each other, which is
unbelievable.
Nice.
Unbelievable.
But okay, when we were growing up, do you remember seeing those commercials for like the purple tinted sunscreens?
Yes.
And you would like go to the beach and see like purple and blue kids running around. Yep, and I think they did this so that parents would know like when the sunscreen has worn off.
Yep.
But now there's so much awareness about synthetic dyes and the negative effects of those.
100%.
So I'm like, this is so crazy that this was a thing and that everyone just went with it and didn't question it. And it just goes to show that not everything that is sold to us is actually safe to use.
Oh, like 1,000,000%. The intentions were good. They wanted, the intention was to make some sort of identifiable product where you can say, okay, my kid's covered or not. And if it's wearing off, they need to reapply. The problem is the stuff we used to do that was worse than the product or concept itself. You touch upon a really important thing. The original FDA manuscript, so the FDA controls sunscreens the way they control medicines. We talked about that it's an over-the-counter regulated drug. So the original manuscript came out in 1999 that defined the most commonly used acceptable chemicals to be used and defined as sunblock or sunscreen in the U.S. And the terminology changed a little bit, but back then it used to be called sunblock. And in order for you to be determined a sunblock, you had to protect the skin against so much redness or burn. The FDA hadn't updated their manuscript until 2 years ago, where they made a statement. They haven't even updated it yet, but they made an update letter or an update statement looking and re-examining after 20 or 30 years worth of data, whether those original chemicals were safe. And 19 of those most readily used stuff that was originally deemed GRACE, generally recognized as safe and effective, are no longer deemed GRACE. So the stuff that we were readily accepting, you're on vacation, you pick it up from the convenience store in the hotel lobby or wherever, or your, you know, local pharmacy, the stuff that was widely accepted is now saying, the FDA itself is saying, I'm not sure this is just as safe as we thought it was. Let's look into it. In fact, they pulled a few things off the shelf, a few older chemical sunscreens, because they provided no benefit and they had some consequence in the studies looking at interference with health. But it's always, especially in the U.S., it's always two steps forward and then half a step sideways or back, you know?
It's like 10 years after something has been used by
millions
of people.
Everyone, yeah.
They then realize that it isn't safe. And so they've come out with this statement and they've pulled a few of these chemicals, but many of them are still being used.
Because so lobbying in the United States is really, really, really strong. And unfortunately, everything is still a business. So the big players that benefit widely from keeping certain things on market have deep pockets. So you can convince governing bodies to do or not do certain things based on whose financial interest it is, right? So a lot of these things that are a problem everywhere else in the world, which have been pulled from many other countries, are still widely available here. Mm. And in fact, there are certain chemical sunscreens available in places like Canada and Europe that are much safer, that don't have the degradation products, but we still can't get them in the U.S.
I've heard about these.
Yeah.
These like new UV
They're filters.
Ingredients.
Yeah.
Okay.
I still, I'm skeptical.
Yeah.
I like the old mineral, mine it from the earth.
Tried and true.
Tried and true.
Because it's also like,
blocker.
What might we possibly find out about those?
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas physical blockers essentially function like clothing, where they sit on the surface of the skin and they shield from UV.
Yeah.
So if you're going to pick something, pick the old time-tested, you know, mine from the earth ingredients.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I feel like we have very similar approaches to sun exposure. Like finding shade is important after being in the sun for a long time. Like you said, you will never burn in the shade.
Exactly.
Wearing protective clothing, wearing hats. But then for the times that I'm maybe like in the water or just in the sun for extended periods of times, I will opt for a physical barrier sunscreen. Non-nano zinc, and we actually are launching one soon, a sunscreen of our own.
Awesome. Amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
Nice.
This is something that's been in the works for so long.
Amazing.
Because like we talked about, it's considered a drug by the FDA. So the processes for testing and whatnot take forever. But you want to take a look?
That's awesome. Love the packaging.
Thanks.
Let's see. So right off the bat, it has a really high zinc concentration, which I like. Because oftentimes we don't get enough sunscreen product on our skin or an active ingredient on our skin. So the lower concentrations of minerals tend to not be as protective as the label suggests. I love the inactives. There's very few of them. All of these my kids can pronounce. I'm just going to feel this.
Yeah, it has a bit of a white cast, but not quite as bad as a lot of other zinc-based sunscreens.
This is awesome.
Particle size is really uniform, the zinc particle size. So it's still non-nano. It'll still sit on the surface of the skin. But the white cast is less
I love
than
the
a lot
feel.
Of other ones.
I love the smell.
I
would put this on my kids.
Yay.
Yeah, for sure.
Great
product.
Approved.
Yeah, totally. Awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah,
so much.
I think it's nice to go back to fundamentals. I love that's probably the highest concentration of zinc I've seen in a very long time. It's great. The inactives are very straightforward. They're biologic, they're organic. I would put this on my family for sure.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Let's transition to internal sun protection.
Sure.
Are there certain nutrients or foods that people should be aware of in terms of giving your body the best defense possible from an internal perspective?
Yeah, I love that. So something that's not commonly known about is things that you can consume that will protect your skin from the inside out. Whereas in many other countries, particularly in South America, this is a well-known phenomenon. There's several ingredients. There's actually a plant that I love and recommend for all of my patients called Polypodium. And it's from a fern in the Amazon rainforest. And this fern was found when we studied a group of indigenous people in the Amazon that would consume this fern before they went out on fishing expeditions on the Amazon. And if they knew they were going to be out for, you know, several days, they would take this fern and they would eat it and it would protect them from burning. So it was essentially like an internal sunscreen or an internal sunshield. So that was identified to be Polypodium. And I recommend that literally for everyone, for anybody who wants another form of sun protection, if you're going to be outside, if you have sun-sensitive skin conditions. I know I see a lot of young women with melasma. We used to call that the mask of pregnancy. And it's this discoloration that's so sensitive to sunlight. It's extremely sensitive to not only UV, but also visible light. And sunscreens don't do a great job shielding the visible component of light, whereas Polypodium does. So there's a lot of things that we can consume or take orally that will actually improve the wellness and vitality of our skin. And there's a lot of science behind this. It's not just assumption or opinion. There's a lot of published data behind all of these ingredients. I help formulate a product called Sun Powder, which is what I recommend for my patients. It's a daily drinkable skin supplement. It's the first of its kind in the market that has all of these ingredients at the clinical dose needed, where you just mix into water and drink once a day. And the premise behind this is if we're doing stuff to our skin from the outside, if we're protecting it, if we're shielding it and sheltering it, at least let's give it a fighting chance from the inside with evidence-based ingredients to help reduce sun damage, sunburn risk, skin cancer risk, and premature aging.
Yeah, absolutely. It's creating resiliency from the inside out.
Yeah. We actually have a clinical trial that I am conducting now at our practice that looks at patients who consume this before and after UV exposure. So it's not just, you know, there's good evidence and science behind it. It's not like a marketing gimmick or ploy, but there's many things that we can learn from other realms, the wellness realm, you know, nutrition, other societies. We found polypodium in the Amazon, you know?
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah. How close to the sun exposure did they consume this to get the protection?
So if you know you're going to be out for a long period of time, or like, let's say you're going on vacation for a week, we found that it builds up tolerance when you take it a week before. But say you don't know and you're going to be out hiking 2 hours before, you can consume this and it'll give you some sun protection. It doubles the time that you can spend outside before your skin burns.
Wow.
Now, it's
so
not.
You've tested this.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of data. There's 10 years worth of data behind
really
it.
Really amazing.
Yeah. It's awesome. And it's not a replacement for sunscreen. Sunscreen has its role in protecting your skin from the outside in. Shade and shelter protect your skin from the outside in. But this is a way to increase your skin's resilience to UV exposure.
I remember seeing something like that on the website. There was some bold claim. I think that was it.
Yeah.
It increases, doubles the amount of time.
Yeah, doubles the amount of time. Yeah,
that's wild.
Exactly. And especially if you know you're going to have like a event coming up or a trip or a hiking, you know, or a fishing trip or what have you.
Yeah.
Starting it a week before increases your skin's UV tolerance even more.
Wow.
Yeah.
I love that it has astaxanthin.
Yeah.
That's an ingredient we use in a lot of our topical skincare products.
Yeah.
And our plumping serum, our antioxidant balm. It's just an amazing antioxidant for the skin.
And it's not well known in the skincare space.
Yeah.
So for some reason, it's like overlooked, but well known more in the wellness, health, nutrition category. There's several really good studies that looked at actual objective changes in skin health and appearance with astaxanthin dosing anywhere from 2 to 12 milligrams. And you saw improvement in tone, texture, elasticity, firmness, and collagen production.
By taking it internally.
By taking it internally.
Wow.
So we added a full clinical dose of that.
Amazing.
It's an amazing antioxidant that nobody talks about.
Right, right. And we have it here, actually.
Yeah.
I'll try it. Cheers.
Cheers.
Sorry I didn't make a liver smoothie for you.
Next time.
Next time.
This is our first year of flavor.
Good.
Yeah, I figured if my kids will like it,
it's really good.
Anybody can like it.
Yeah.
Thanks.
If someone's already taking like a multivitamin, is it okay to take this at the same time?
100%. Okay. So everything is water soluble. Everything is at the right clinical dose, but doesn't interact with any medications that we know of.
Yeah.
There's also bioactive collagen in there. There's hyaluronic acid in there, vitamin C, glutathione, a few other goodies.
Yeah.
But doesn't interact with anything you take.
What about foods to avoid? Is there anything that you would recommend people not consume if they want to increase their resilience to the sun on an internal level?
So that's a tough question because we haven't identified foods yet that will necessarily increase your susceptibility to sunburns or sun damage, but we do know foods that will weaken your skin's immune system and make your skin health worse. And what do I mean by this? So we've known for many, many years, and I practice this in my practice, that certain diets, certain foods will improve skin disease. We can improve eczema, we can improve psoriasis, we can improve acne. These are quintessential skin problems with diet. Will they cure them? Not necessarily per se, but will they improve them? By far.
I've never heard a dermatologist say that.
Oh, it's really
important.
And
I struggled with acne in junior high, high school. I remember point blank asking my dermatologist, is there anything I can change about my diet or lifestyle that will help this? And she said, no, it is purely genetic. There's nothing you can do. Just keep taking these antibiotics on and off for years and years and years and putting these creams on your face.
No. So I'm sorry about that because we do know, and the evidence has gotten better and better over the last several years. And fortunately, I trained up at Stanford. They were very forward thinking in not just medicine, but also identifying other causes that can improve skin health. That's not just give a drug. So we learned this during training, and there was great evidence behind it as we got better in understanding skin disease. But we know for certain high glycemic index foods, high inflammatory foods, and non-fat or skim dairy products will worsen skin disease. Now, everybody's scratching their head. They've heard dairy or the controversy behind dairy, but a really nice study came out of a very good university in Pittsburgh that showed that actually it's not dairy itself, but it's the emulsifiers that we put in non-fat or skim dairy products to give it the mouthfeel of full fat that triggers the worsening of acne. Whole fat, whole milk dairy products didn't. Non-fat and skim dairy products did. And you can replicate this in clinic. You can tell patients, I wouldn't recommend to do this, but you can tell patients if you go on a non-fat dairy product, watch, your skin will get worse. And they do. But when they go on a full fat, or what, you know, my parents call as natural or normal, if they go on a full fat dairy diet, their skin disease improves.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a difference even in the category of whole fat between raw versus pasteurized?
Good question. I don't know if there's evidence to it yet. I think I would presume the live version would tend to be more beneficial. And that's touching upon a very interesting topic, and that's the gut microbiome, the skin microbiome, the immune homeostasis between them. But I would presume that the raw version would be a little bit better. Now, there's an asterisk to that, because pasteurization has been a problem, but it's also been a benefit in many settings. Across the world, the quality of food and food services is not uniform. So for me to say, you know, raw is great, may be great in places where we have good, you know, farming quality, good animal hygiene, you know, good techniques to get raw dairy products. Perhaps in other parts of the country or other parts of the world, the quality is not the same. And that's where some illnesses come into play. But I don't know yet. I think give it 10 years. And if somebody studies that, I would bet that the raw version would be better than the pasteurized version. But for sure, we know high glycemic index. What does that mean? Sugary foods. You know, my mom always told me, don't eat that candy. And I was like, as a kid, I'm like, Mom, what are you talking about? And now I'm like, don't eat that candy, to my very own kid. Because we know not only does it's not good for you, but you actually see skin disease get worse. And the other thing is, we talk about inflammatory foods. So what are inflammatory foods? Like, what this definition of anti-inflammatory versus inflammatory. And inflammatory foods tend to be ultra processed, tend to be heavy processed grain-based diets, and they tend to be full of oils or fats that are not what I call biologic, meaning seed oil heavy, preservative heavy foods. These tend to be more inflammatory. Why inflammatory foods are a problem is we have to understand our gut is a whole other ecosystem that we're just starting to understand, you know, and there's amazing labs that are just looking at what the gut does. And the gut itself plays an incredible role in our skin health. And that's because the microorganisms that we have in our gut metabolize our food. We consume our food, and the nutrients are pulled by the microorganisms that reside naturally in our gut. Those microorganisms have preferences as what they can metabolize and what they cannot metabolize. So when you feed your body things that aren't meant to be digested regularly, or that our ancestral bacteria can't digest naturally, the metabolic waste products that they produce tend to be inflammatory. They trigger an immune response that wouldn't be triggered. So we see that the first place we see that is in our skin. Psoriasis gets worse, eczema gets worse, your acne gets worse. And then you see it in other things too. You know, patients who have joint disease, arthritis, you know, osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, they'll say their joints hurt more when they have a pizza, beer, and, you know, donut diet, as opposed to animal proteins, fruits and vegetables, you know, farm to table style.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, you just touched on so many important things. Like the skin, it's a part of our body, and it just makes sense that when these things show up, yeah, we should view them as warning signs.
Yeah, 100%.
And opportunities to tune in and think, okay, what needs to be 100%. Corrected here, versus the more traditional Western model of just masking everything. And it's really refreshing to hear you say that as a dermatologist, and appreciate to hear that. Hopefully things are maybe starting to shift within the field of dermatology.
For sure.
Into looking at things more on an internal level versus just covering up symptoms with like steroid creams and antibiotics and all those
things. For sure. There's a time and place for everything. I think with severe disease of any kind, you can't replace certain medicines with lifestyle changes. But to ignore lifestyle changes and negate them and not playing a role in our health is craziness. Mm-hmm. One of the things that drove me into dermatology, and one of the things I love about our skin, is you can see right away the status of your health. Mm-hmm. Very rarely, how often has somebody come up to you and say, how's your liver doing, you know, or how is your heart health? We don't really see that day to day, but I can see just looking at your skin, how you're doing. I can see whether you're ill. I can see whether you're glowing, you're healthy and vibrant. I can see if your hair and nails are growing, you're probably doing well internally. If you're sick, there's changes I can see. If you have immune dysregulation, I can see it in your skin. If you're inflamed, I can see it in your skin. So listening to our like biosensor, which is our skin, is an easy way to say, hey, let me tweak this. Or maybe I need to go outside, or maybe I need to change my diet a little bit. Maybe having donuts for breakfast is probably not the smartest idea. Though I love me a donut, I try to minimize it, you know?
Going back to sunlight, our philosophy is that there are so many benefits of getting adequate natural sunlight. What are some of those benefits that the sun provides for us?
So, completely agree. Light in particular is medicine. And we use light every single day in dermatology. Sunlight itself is like the most original ancestral form of light that we have. There's a component of physical wellness that we get and a component of wellness and mental health that we get that may be less measurable. But right off the bat, the discussion about vitamin D is really important. We get vitamin D from sun exposure or supplements. I tend to find sun exposure to be more natural form, and I tend to recommend it for everybody. That being said, I would, you know, listen to whatever your doctor suggests in terms of what you need medically, but I love being outside 20, 30 minutes a day, morning or afternoon, just enough to stimulate my skin's ability to produce some vitamin D. That's right off the bat. We know that sunlight, particularly certain wavelengths of sunlight, can modulate our skin's immune system. And we've harnessed that to actually treat skin disease. So when patients come into my office and many other practices, and they have psoriasis, or they have eczema that isn't controlled, or they want a natural source, I actually use phototherapy. And phototherapy is a very precise wavelength of light that we learned from many, 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 many years ago, where patients would sit and bathe in mud and get sunlight to treat their skin disease. And we would see this, you know, in the Middle East very frequently. We would see this in other countries where patients were instructed to go lay in the Dead Sea mud, rub it all over their skin, and lay outside in the sun to improve skin disease. When we studied that, we found that actually light will modulate our skin's immune system. It will actually calm it down. So I have many patients who, you know, self-medicate by going outside and getting some sun, and their skin disease gets better. So even in the office, we utilize light to treat a variety of conditions. You know, even things like vitiligo, where patients lose skin color because of an autoimmune condition, we utilize UV light, very specific wavelengths of UV light, to treat their skin without the need for medicine or pills or certain drugs. So light itself is totally medicine. I myself have psoriasis, and during the summer, my psoriasis gets better. I'm outside longer. I'm getting more UV on my skin. Now, I'm not burning, so I know my skin's tolerance and how much I can get, and everybody should know that. For example, I can be outside for an hour before my skin turns red or burns, so I'll be outside just before that. If you tell me I can go outside for 20 minutes and then my skin turns red, I would say go out for 15 minutes and you'll be fine. So I love sunlight. I love light. We utilize light for many different things. And in fact, being in Los Angeles, being in the 21st century, cosmetics is very big, and we utilize light sources for cosmetic treatments as well. All of the lasers that we use in skin come from understanding how light modulates our skin. We call it photobiomodulation. So we can harness specific wavelengths of light to treat certain parts of the skin. Now, I brought this up being on a farm. You know, too much of a good thing can be a bad thing. You know, leave some animal hide outside in the sun for 30 days and it starts to turn into leather. So I'm not saying go outside indefinitely and don't do the stuff that's trending now on social media, like the perineal tanning and the people laying outside with, you know, their legs up in the air. I don't think that's the smartest idea, but I think getting sun is great.
Yeah, I do think it's important to have a healthy respect for the sun and recognize that it can cause damage in excess.
Yeah.
And that's why recently I had a screening, a full body screening for moles. Like I'm a moley person. I have a lot of moles and I hadn't had one in a really long time. And we're launching an SPF. I was like, I feel like I should just do this.
For sure.
And it was, I was actually really surprised. It was really quick and easy and everything came back good.
Excellent.
But what are your thoughts on the importance of like regular screening?
Love it. Love it. I'm biased. I am a dermatologist and a skin cancer surgeon. So for me, catching things earlier, and this is true across all of medicine, but catching things earlier results in better outcomes. Skin screenings are so easy to do. You mentioned it. It's not invasive like getting a colonoscopy or a CT scan of your lungs or something. It's quick. It's painless. There's no added medicine that you need. There's no added procedure. You don't need to go to the hospital for this. You don't need any anesthesia for this. And any good dermatologist should be looking at your skin from the top of your scalp to the bottom of your toes and every square inch, because in essence, you can develop something anywhere. You know, I talk about this all the time, but Bob Marley died of a melanoma on his toenail. And he would have never thought that he was susceptible to that. Actually, he thought it was a soccer injury and a bruise. So every square inch should be examined, but it's so easy to do. And I would recommend it because best case scenario, nothing shows up. Worst case scenario, you find something and you find it early and we can treat it.
Yeah. She had like a little thing.
Yes. A dermatoscope. I love that thing.
What does it do?
It helps us identify features under the microscope that will tell us, okay, is this harmless or is this something that needs to come off?
So it's just a little magnifier.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Pattern recognition.
I thought you she was like screening and it was like coming up with like a yes or no.
Oh, no, we're almost there. We're not there yet, but yeah, we're almost there. There's like, and that's the realm of AI and medicine and the interface between computers and humans. But what we've learned in training is pattern recognition. So we look at this under a lighted microscope. We call it epiluminescence transmicroscopy, a fancy name for a shiny microscope on your skin. And we can see certain patterns or features that tell us with good confidence, this needs to come off or this is a harmless mole or a pimple or a growth.
Okay. And if people wanted to do any sort of like self-checking, are there certain signs that people can look out for in their own moles if they're just looking at themselves?
Totally. So we talked about skin cancer is the most common cancer in the world and 1 in 4 Americans will develop this at some point in their life. So it is something to, you know, pay attention to. The earliest and most common sign is a pimple or a bump that won't go away in a month. So if you think you have a pimple or a bug bite, mosquito bite, ingrown hair, what have you, they usually resolve within a month. If they're there longer than that, see your dermatologist. If you're washing your face or rubbing your skin and you notice something bleed easily, that's the most common sign of a basal cell carcinoma. And that is something that can be easily treated when caught early. See your dermatologist. In terms of moles, we look for the ugly duckling or something that is new or changing. So if you have a lot of moles, you've gotten a sense of your skin just every single day, showering and changing, what your normal pattern looks like. And I don't expect anybody to make a diagnosis. I don't expect anybody to tell me this is harmless, this is malignant, etc. You know an ugly duckling when you see it. You're like, hey, this mole looks different. This is catching my eye. You should see your dermatologist. And something that's easy to do, and I recommend this for anybody who has a lot of moles, is mole selfies. It's like literally what it sounds like, is have somebody, or you can do it yourself, take a good resolution photograph, either on a smartphone or a tablet, of areas that have a lot of moles. And once a month, or even once every other month, just match them after the shower. And you can say, hey, that mole's there, that mole's there. This is new. This isn't in the photo. See your dermatologist.
I've heard you talk about how moles can shift and change with hormone fluctuations.
Yes.
And
yes.
I've noticed that pregnancy, I've seen that. Is that something, is that like a red flag or is that just normal?
That's totally normal. So moles are under progesterone response. So you can see this in women who are on birth control, in women who are pregnant, in moles will get darker. They can develop what's called the linea nigra, or dark streak on their abdomen. And that's also the same reason why melasma shows up and gets darker during pregnancy or when you're on birth control. So our pigmented friends or our freckles or moles can get darker with pregnancy. Now, that doesn't mean you get a carte blanche to say, hey, anything goes, anything dark during pregnancy is normal. If you notice a mole that's changing faster, if you notice a new mole that wasn't there, still see your dermatologist, but definitely things can change during pregnancy and they regress after delivery or if you stop birth control, anything that stops the progesterone response, the color will lighten over the coming months.
I love that you call yourself the anti-dermatologist.
I mean, I agree with that. Yeah.
And I mentioned earlier a little bit about my experience and going to a dermatologist for my acne in junior high school and was pretty much prescribed every Band-Aid under the planet, some of which helped for a little while, some of which I think caused more damage than if I had just done nothing to begin with. And I'm curious, as a dermatologist, what would you say most dermatologists are getting wrong, whether it's a mindset or a practice? What's like the biggest thing that you think dermatologists are thinking about in the wrong way?
I think this will apply to all doctors is not listening to their patient. Because we're trained to think that we know better. And we may know disease better. We may know maybe pathophysiology better of how disease develops, but you know your body way better than I will ever know it. So if you come in and tell me, hey, like my acne is flaring, and I don't sit down and say, hey, like, what's your life like? Oh, well, I started a new job, or I'm in finals week, or, you know, I was divorced or what have you. And I don't take into consideration, oh, my diet is terrible. I started a new medication. I don't listen to you and find out what's going on in your life besides saying, acne is caused by this, therefore treat it with this. I've done you no service. So the far and beyond the simplest thing that we can fix is listen to the patient. In addition to that, I think it's keeping an open mind to alternatives that may have not been taught in strictly in medical school that have been tried and true in other societies, other cultures, and maybe even in our own population that isn't in medical textbooks, but works, right? It's funny, the older I get, the more I realize my grandparents and parents were right about a lot of things that I like waved off during my training. You know, you go through college and you go through medical school, very science-oriented, very, not to say westernized, but westernized. And then you come out, you practice a little bit, you see some bad things, you see some good things, and you're like, wait a second, they were right about this. Yeah. I can go out in the sun. It'll make me feel a little better. I shouldn't eat that. They're right. This is bad for my skin, bad for my health. But because it wasn't in my textbook, I didn't know about it or think it was true. So keeping an open approach or an open eye, like I talk about the sun all the time. All the time. I'm outside all the time. I got three kids. I'm running around outside all the time. They play a lot of sports. We're outdoors. I know the sun is safe within a reasonable amount. I respect it. I love it. I don't abuse my sun exposure, but it's almost blasphemy for me to advocate sun exposure as a dermatologist, but I don't think there's anything wrong with it. So keeping an open perspective and an open viewpoint will change medicine for the better.
Before we wrap up, I have to ask you about spray tans.
Yeah.
Because yeah. The last time I got a spray tan was maybe, I think, for my bachelorette party, so a long time ago. And I recently went on a trip with a good friend. She had just gotten a spray tan. It looked so good. So I had my assistant do some research in looking into like what's actually in a spray tan. And a lot of these places, they advertise to be organic spray tans. I was like, what is that? What are the ingredients in these things? And she came back to me with several ingredient lists. And it was like full of petrochemicals, red 40, yellow 5, all the dyes. I'm like, how are these things like, quote, organic? It's crazy. Is there such a thing as a non-toxic or what you would consider to maybe be like less toxic or safe spray tan?
If we're going to pick tanning, okay, and I don't think tans are a bad thing per se. I think the problem is the pursuit of a tan. I think I tan very easily. That's what my skin's natural biology does. In somebody who is blonde hair and blue eyed, their skin will not naturally tan. So their pursuit of a tan creates a problem. If you're going to pick between tanning, I think spray tans are safer than trying to get a tan in a tanning bed, by far. I don't think anybody should tan in a tanning bed. There's nothing beneficial that you'll get from concentrated UV exposure. If you get a tan inadvertently because you're outside in the sun, you're on vacation, you're hiking, you're playing with your kids. I think biologically that tends to be better than chemical spray tans or artificial tans. But for the most part, the way spray tans work is it's a chemical that goes on your skin that undergoes an oxidative process. And in that oxidation, it changes a color. It's essentially paint.
And you're inhaling it.
You are, for sure. You are, for sure. Do I like it? No. If I had to pick the lesser of the two evils, because I know, for example, I can't convince a group of women who are about to have a great event or a wedding or a bachelorette party that they're going to do it anyway, pick the spray tan, not the tanning bed. I think we talk about this concept of organic and natural, right? And I bring two important things up. Oil from the ground is natural. We wouldn't drink it, right? Mm-hmm. But it's natural. Mm-hmm. Poison oak is organic and all natural. I wouldn't rub it on my skin, right? Mm-hmm. So we've learned to market certain terms to the consumer to make them think it's safe or completely harmless, and it's not. You know?
Yeah, not everything that grows 100%. From the earth is safe.
Yeah. Run into some poison oak. You'll be scratching for days. Yeah. Well, you know, if you avoid it, is it any problem? No, of course not. You know, mm-hmm. But you have to be very cognizant as to what you're doing. A spray tan is not a natural thing. You mm-hmm. cannot farm this. You cannot grow this. So you know it's some chemical derivative. But I also tend to be pragmatic. You know, people are going to do things. And if I can at least guide them in the direction of the least damage, if it's every once in a while, it's okay. If it's a daily or monthly thing, now we're talking about inhalational hazards. We're talking about certain chemicals that will be on your skin and maybe absorbed over time. A lot of stuff that's just in the gray area where FDA doesn't really regulate. We don't know what we're doing. So figuring out how often you're doing it, you know, once in a while, maybe okay. If it's becoming a routine thing, don't do it.
Yeah. Gel manicures are also getting a lot of heat and questions right now. Yeah. Are these contributing to skin cancer?
Great question. A lot of controversy, a lot of virality in videos on social media and even advisory statements from dermatologists about gel manicures. And why that's a big deal is that oftentimes gels have to be cured with a UV lamp where you stick your hands in and get UV exposure to cure the gel onto the nail. We theorize, or at least discuss, that probably getting UV on your fingernails is not the greatest idea. And we've thought, at least dermatologists collectively have thought, that this increases the susceptibility for certain skin cancers under the nail. Now, my practice and myself, we've developed a reputation for doing the most nail surgeries and probably all of Los Angeles. So I see a lot of melanoma and squamous cell carcinoma of the fingernail. What I do know and what the evidence suggests is it's not exactly straightforward. The majority of squamous cells on the fingernails actually arise from HPV, not gel manicures.
Wow.
And melanomas that occur on the nail or underneath the nail tend to have a mutation profile that is not directly UV exposure related. So it may not increase your risk directly, but what we do know is that it ages your hand prematurely. When you're sticking it under that UV box, we know for certain that UV exposure will wrinkle and pigment your skin faster than if you didn't. And one of the quickest places people see age is their hands. Mm-hmm. So what a lot of my derm colleagues do, and what I recommend for, you know, friends and family, if they like getting gel manicures done, is wear a glove. Protective glove. Usually the gel itself is protective from UV penetrating to the nail bed. I'm not worried about that. And if you're worried about aging or wrinkling, wear a UV protective glove.
I've never heard that HPV can cause cancer under the nail.
Yeah.
Where else can HPV cause cancer?
Yeah, great question. It's the number one cause of head and neck throat cancer in the United States. It's the number one cause of squamous cell carcinoma of the genital region in both men and women. Historically, it was the number one cause of cancer deaths in young women ages 25 to 45 as cervical cancer. That's changed a lot over the last 10 years, partly due to Gardasil, partly due to awareness, partly due to early detection. But HPV is a nasty little virus. It most commonly shows up as warts. Mm. Warts in kids, hands, feet, you know. And those are benign, but they come with an invisible sibling, which is the high-risk strains, which can cause a lot of cancer. I do a lot of posting about this and bring awareness because people don't recognize that this is a source of skin cancer and they always blame the sun. And I probably operate on half a dozen skin cancers in the genital area and on the hands and feet a month. And none of these are sun related.
So you don't blame the sun. Tell by looking at the cancer whether or not it's sun related.
Yeah. And you can, if you even wanted to, you can go further and test the tissue for certain features that suggest whether this is from the sun, HPV, et cetera, et cetera.
Dr. Teo, thank you so much for being here. The world needs more dermatologists like you.
I think
people are going to get a lot out of this conversation. It was so enlightening.
I had a blast. Thank you for having me. We talked about a lot of fun things. And if I can be of any help to anybody, please don't hesitate to reach out. We have a small social media presence. You can message me. You can text me. You can email me. Any which way I can help anybody listening to this, happy to help.
That's so generous. And where can people find your sun powder?
Oh, appreciate that. So it's on our website, sunpowder.co. All the science is there. All of our clinical trials are there. The data is there. There's a small Instagram handle called Drink Sunpowder. You can find out more information. I have a small social media handle. It's just my name, last name, MD. If you want to see what we do, what we provide in our practice, and honestly, just skin health information. I'm happy to help.
Well, we'll have to have you back sometime because there's so much we didn't cover today. We covered the sun, but there's so much more that I could have asked you.
Yeah, I can talk for hours.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back. Thank you so much.
Thank you, of course.